everybody. I'm just testing Anna. Can you hear me?
I can.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, I think we'll get started then. Sensational. Well, welcome everybody. Thank you so much for joining me on this live chat seminar. My name is Sue Larkey and my aim in the next 45 minutes is to give you lots of practical ideas. I want to get the most out of this call, so please print out the handout document, which you'll see on the live chat page. And I'd also recommend having a pen and highlighter ready to take notes as Anna and I discuss strategies. Some of the other tip sheets we'll be discussing tonight, well, depending on time, but we will hopefully get to, are also available on my website at www.sulaarkey, which is one word, SueLarkey.com, and you can download the handout and tip sheets that we're going to discuss. After the call, Anna and I will be on Facebook to take your questions and for people to discuss key points together, so I'd encourage you to friend me on Facebook as soon as possible so you can engage in that conversation. Tonight I'm interviewing Anna Tallemans, who I've written a number of books with, and I always think having a parent and a teacher writing books together is a wonderful combination. I remember when Anna and I first wrote our first book, The Essential Guide to Secondary, how we would sit down and talk things through, and I would often sort of say to Anna, what do you think about this? And she'd come up with an idea and I'd go, oh, you can't really do that at school. And then I'd come up with an idea and she'd say, that doesn't really work at home. And so what we had to do is put in our books the things that work for both of us. And I guess that's why our books are so popular with parents and schools, that they combine practical strategies for home and school and which work across both environments. So welcome, Anna. I really appreciate you joining me, especially as I know you got back from New Zealand today and for your body clock, you're on much later than our time. So, Anna, I was hoping you can just share with everyone your journey of getting Daniel diagnosed and just share a little bit about that.
Thank you, Sue, and welcome home as well. I'd love to share my story about Daniel. We had a fairly interesting journey with Daniel. When he was very young, he didn't like to be cuddled, but he loved being wrestled on the ground, and he loved being squeezed very tight, but not a hug. It had to be a really hard squeeze. And at the age of 2, he was talking about hydraulic systems, and by the age of 4, he was reading newspapers, and he loved looking at fact books and reading them and remembering all of these facts. So we had a fairly brilliant boy on our hands. And having had very little experience with other children, as he was my first child, we thought things were going along fairly well until we got to school. When we got to school, we found that he had a lot of difficulty socializing with the other children. He kept to himself quite a lot. He really didn't play that well with other children. And when we actually got into grade 1, the first school that we attended, he actually got beaten up in the playground by the grade 7s. So we moved him to another school because the principal of that school said, well, you know, he's got to learn to grow up in the playground at some stage. And we thought, this is not on. So we moved him to another school. And then this other school, the teacher there kept saying, there's just something I can't reach in Daniel. There's just something there. So we went off to see a psychologist. And after spending about an hour with the psychologist, she ended up giving us this little diagnosis called Asperger syndrome, which, considering that he's now almost 26 years old, at the age of 6, there wasn't very much information about it out there. She actually gave us 3 things about Asperger syndrome. She said he'd never marry and never have children, he'd never learn to drive a car, and he'd probably suicide by the time he was 15. So that was our introduction to Asperger syndrome.
Anna, sorry, I'm just sitting here, and I know I've heard you talk a little bit about this before, but I just get tingly when I hear that, considering the beautiful man that you now have, who's 26 and drives and has achieved so much. When a parent hears that, it must be so hard to listen to that. So I guess people listening probably now would like to know a little bit about, I wasn't actually going to go into what Daniel's now doing, but if you could just maybe just update us on on Daniel's journey and where he is up to today, so that people know that those three things really haven't happened at all for Daniel.
No, not at all. He's actually a very healthy young man. He goes to gym 5 days a week. He's actually working in IT situation at the moment. He's been there for about 3.5 years, almost 4 years now. So he's holding down a permanent job. He went through university, got his degree, and you know, did all very, very well, considering what this psychologist told us all those years ago. It has been an interesting journey for him and for us as a family as well.
Absolutely. And I guess when you got that diagnosis 20-odd years ago, it was very similar to the time I started in autism. There was no books around or the internet. You couldn't get on the internet to look up what Asperger's syndrome was. And I know that you were sort of proactive in setting up one of the first support groups. But mm-hmm. it must have been very isolating trying to connect with other people. So, and I know you wrote...
It was very difficult because...
Yeah, you go, Anna.
It was very difficult because there wasn't a lot of information out there. And you just couldn't jump onto the internet and look up Asperger and get all of this wonderful stuff that we've got out there now and sift through it and decide, well, this is going to be good for my child, but that one isn't. So we actually went through tons of books that were very much medically directed. And so it was very difficult for us. And that was one of the reasons why I did start the support group up here in Queensland, just so that other parents had information at their fingertips so that they didn't have to go through some of the issues that we went through.
Absolutely. And I know very early on or somewhere in there you wrote your book Talking to Family and Friends about Diagnosis. Could you sort of share a bit of what you put in that book and why you wrote that book?
Well, I can. It was very interesting, actually. It started out because I'm from an Italian family, a very large Italian family. So we have a lot of... how can I say this in a lovely way? We have a lot of gatherings where we have lots and lots and lots of people. And, of course, one of the things that Daniel found difficulty with was being in large crowds. And we're very stereotypically Italian in that we are very effusive. We're very over the top. Lots of loud words, lots of huge hugs, lots of banter going on between people. And, of course, Daniel would just fall apart as soon as he started seeing the family arrive. He'd go running for the hills. So what I needed to do was try and get the family to understand the issues that were surrounding Daniel. And what I did was wrote this book for them so that they had an understanding of what were some of the things that I needed to get through to them. For example, some of the strategies that I was using at home would be working perfectly in other people's homes as well. And so it was trying to convince them that they needed to actually use these strategies. So I started writing down some things and putting a few words together and then handing them out to all of the family and saying, look, if you can just do this one thing, you'll find Daniel will be a much calmer boy when he comes to visit your house. One of the things that Daniel used to do when he was young was whenever we visited someone, and it didn't matter how many times we went to this person's house, he had to actually go into the kitchen, open up all of your kitchen cupboard doors, have a look at all of the appliances that you had, and then come back out and announce very loudly, well, where is your Kenwood? We have a Kenwood, why don't you?
Oh, Anna.
These are just some of the things that I needed to get through to my family that Daniel needed to do. He could not sit still until he had done this particular thing. So it was one of those interesting things. We also needed to talk about siblings and how the siblings were going to cope with him. So we needed to, in the book I actually wrote down some things that we needed to talk to the siblings about so that they knew how to cope with the issues that Daniel was facing. And, of course, they had their own issues as well because they actually went to school together and shared quite a number of friendships. So they could also see some of the issues that were happening at school and were very, very concerned about what was happening for Daniel. So we needed to find some strategies to help them cope as well. Then the third thing, of course, was friends. Friends was a huge issue for us as a couple. when Daniel was diagnosed, we did lose quite a number of friends because they couldn't cope with the idea that there was this thing that he had. Maybe it might rub off and get onto my children. So it was finding some solutions for them as well. What was it that they could do to help Daniel when we went to visit them or if they came to visit us? So that was also an interesting part of writing the book.
I was just going to say that what I'm hearing, and this is, I guess, why I love writing books with you and what I love about you as a parent is, Anna, it would have been so easy for you and Marty just to say, well, we won't visit friends, we won't go to big family functions, but you have been incredibly proactive. That makes a huge difference, but knowing you, I guess there would have been some tears and anguish in there too with frustration. Were there people you just had to go, well, actually, they don't get Daniel, we can't continue, you know, you had to cut off ties with relationships too, not just people cut off ties the other way around?
Yes, no, we did the same thing because there were some people that just didn't get it and just didn't understand the pressures that we were facing ourselves as a couple and as a family. With all of the other family issues that were happening. So, yeah, there were friendships where we just had to go, well, okay, maybe that's just not worth pursuing any further. And taking up other friendships that were out there and available to us that at first we hadn't thought about. And I think probably for me it was actually meeting lots of other people who were in the same situation and socialising with other people who had children diagnosed with all forms of ASD. And that was a great way to form friendships because everyone understood whatever it was that Daniel was doing. And it was kind of like, oh, he does that too. Oh, I don't feel so bad. It was an actual opportunity to actually find other friends who were much more accepting. So it was really good.
Oh, Anna, that's fantastic. Sorry, I interrupted you a moment ago. You were going to say the third thing about talking to family and friends. Was there something I cut off there?
Well, the last thing I wanted to mention was about being a friend, how to be a friend to someone with ASD. And I also included that in the book as so many of the cousins were finding it a little bit difficult in understanding how to be a friend to Daniel, not just being a cousin where you see each other and play together, but actually a true friend where they actually enjoyed playing with him rather than just looking after him, if you understand what I mean. So there were some strategies in there that they also found helpful as well. So I needed to include all of those things as well as the grandparents, specific things for grandparents as well.
Absolutely. And I can imagine with the culture of the Italian background where a lot of the responsibility for Daniel's behaviour, people would have looked at you, educating the grandparents would have been vital.
Absolutely vital.
Yeah,
I did three parenting skills programs.
Didn't you fail your parenting skills programs, Anna?
I did. 3 times.
I must say, I think a few people listening have been to my sessions would have heard me refer to your failing the parenting skills, which makes sense because having a very literal son and the normal strategies of time out and so forth just tend not to work for these kids. You need a parenting skills for ASD kids, which today, 20 years on, I think the parenting programs are far more understanding of diagnosis. But back then, as you said, everything was very medical. So a lot of people running positive parenting programs or the equivalent, they wouldn't have understood Daniel either.
That's exactly right. They really found it quite difficult because, that, like you said, they were from the medical background, whereas nowadays a lot of the strategies that we put in place for our ASD children work for our typical children as well, especially in the parenting programs. And they've seen that. And so the parenting programs now are much more focused on a more general way of bringing up children rather than the old traditional way.
Absolutely. Oh. Now, Anna, on Facebook last week, I sort of said to people, what questions did they want me to ask you? And so many people wanting to know about transition. And I guess I'd really like to have time to spend a little bit of time on transition. But I know you and I, in our books, we really focus on, it's not just transition from preschool to school or primary school to secondary, every year you need to readdress that. And I think it's in our blue book. We talk about a little boy that moved from downstairs to upstairs and no one had done a transition, but to him it was like a whole new school being on another level. So I was hoping you could spend a little bit of time explaining about transition and what worked for Daniel. And I know you support a lot of other kids than just Daniel, but sort of give us some ideas and your experiences.
Yeah, well, I have an exact example just from New Zealand. As you said, I came back from New Zealand this morning, and yesterday I was with a parent whose child was really struggling because they took him out of a particular class where he'd spent three quarters of the year, and in this last term, they actually put him into a different classroom without any of the preparation, without any of the transition programming, and he is just falling apart in that room. You know, for me, one of the biggest issues is preparation. Preparation for the child, but also preparation for the teacher. So getting the child ready, but also getting the teacher ready so that she understands the issues that he is going to be facing, and she will understand that he needs some coping strategies in place before he actually moves into her classroom.
Absolutely. And can you share some of the ways you've done that over the years, Anna?
Yeah. Well, for transition, even for Daniel, it was always really difficult because he's such a visual learner. And just telling him about what was going to be new was never enough. We always needed to show him pictures of what the new thing was. But what I found worked really, really well was showing him what was new and what was different from the old things. So we would have a transition workbook that I worked with him, and we'd put in pictures of what the old thing was, what was happening there, what all of the old things looked like. Then we'd also do a new one with all of the new pictures, and then we'd look at that one and share the differences between the two. So when he moved from grade one into grade two, we showed him all of the pictures of the grade one classroom and all of the rules and things that went with the grade one classroom. Then we showed him the new book, which then had all of the new pictures of the grade two classroom, which then had the new teacher, the new rules, all of those things. And then we talked about the differences and why the differences were happening. And that made it so much easier for him to cope with the transition process. And we just did that every year from year to year. And then also we moved several schools because we moved states a number of times as well. So we would often show pictures of where we were going to, what the differences were, and what he could do with the differences as well. You know, how was he going to cope with the school toilets being in a different area? How was he going to cope with having the tuck shop over on the south side of the school instead of the north side of the school? So they were all things that we sat down and worked out before he actually went into the new environment. So it was talking about the new environment, showing new pictures of the new environment, and then showing the differences.
Absolutely, and allowing him to refer back to that, which is like I would say, I'm sure, Anna, you flying today, you would have checked your ticket a few times what time the flight was, even though it wouldn't have changed. It just calms you seeing the ticket time and looking at that. And I think we all do that. We like looking, you know, checking what time things are, but I particularly notice it when I'm catching a plane. So when we set up the visuals for the kids to refer back to, it's so important. And while you're talking, it just reminded me of one of my little boys who had his class photo from his first year at school, so depending what state, prep, kindy, wherever you live. And he used to wipe out the children who weren't going to be in his class the next year. It was like having little ghost pictures on the photo each year. But for him, that was really, really important, knowing who was going to be in his class. And I think
yes.
This is the thing with Asperger's kids, particularly. People forget that friendship stuff is so important to these guys and often causes them as much anxiety as which teacher they've got.
Yes, that is so true. And knowing that these same faces are going to be in there at that next level as well is a calming process for them as well. Knowing that that's something else they don't have to learn about, some new, because a lot of them find it very difficult recognising faces as it is. So new faces take a long time for them to remember. So having the old faces in the same classroom really helps them to settle much faster.
Absolutely. Now, I'm just looking. I've got in front of me, Anna, your I'm Going to School book and one that's blank, your blank workbook, which is just fantastic, and the demonstration one you've sent through all filled in. And I'm just thinking I might try and put a couple of pictures of that on Facebook tomorrow so people can see the inside of that book and it's filled in. But you've got things like a Google map of where the school's going to be located, a picture layout of the classroom. And I just think all those things. So even if teachers, schools can't let kids know who the teacher's going to be before the end of the year, even if they can just start to get them used to other places in the school, invite them to visit a range of teachers who might be the option. But I know for some of my families, inviting the kid in that day that the staff are back and not the other kids, and giving them a chance to see where they're going to hang their bag, where their table is, to see the teacher without everyone else in the room. And for me, these kids have a sixth sense, and that first day back at school when everyone else is a bit nervous and anxious, they can't focus on that stuff, but if they can come in the day before when no one's in the room and just, you know, 10, 15 minutes would make a huge difference. So is there any other tips you've got along those lines?
Yes. Look, there's quite a few tips, but if I was here, we'd be here all night. I'll give you some five good tips for our children. One of the first things that we need to know for our children is how to open their lunch boxes. Now, I know that sounds very small and insignificant, but I see so many of our ASD children in schools who don't have the manipulative skills to actually open their own lunchbox. So they either won't have lunch or just leave it in their bag and then get into trouble for not actually eating their lunch by the teachers. The other thing I see is that they can't open their sandwiches. If they actually get into the lunchbox, they can't actually get it past the cling wrap, because the cling wrap is so tightly wound on. So making sure that they're able to do that is a first step. The other thing is getting them to know the new environment. And like you said, get them in the day before when teachers are there but none of the other students are there, because they are very good at remembering where things are as long as they don't have all of the stresses around them of other kids, the noises, the sensory issues, all of those things happening. They will remember their maps really, really easily. So knowing where to put my bag before all the rush happens is so much easier to get there. It's a little bit like us when we look up on Google Maps before we go somewhere, so that we orientate ourselves to where we need to be on what roads. And then when we're actually on the road, it's not quite so nerve-wracking for us. And if we make a wrong turn, we know, oh, yes, I know, on Google Maps, you can just go down a little bit further and I can turn around and come back. So it just de-stresses our children so much. The other thing to make sure is that they know where the safe toilets are. Now, I know that also sounds really silly, but toilets are the places where our children will get bullied if they're going to get bullied. So finding toilets that are close to staff rooms that these children can walk into very safely and be able to walk out of there without anything else happening. The other thing is marking any out-of-bounds areas. Our children just love exploring, and because they do tend to be by themselves, they explore very, very well. Now, remembering that our children are sometimes 3 to 5 years behind their peers, what they do is they love playing with the younger children, because younger children play the same way that they like to play. I can boss these little kids around and these little kids are saying, yay, someone's playing with me and I'll do whatever he wants. So they'll go and find the infants area and play with kids there. Or what they'll do is they'll go and find the grade sevens and play with the grade sevens, because the grade sevens will come down to their level and play with them and let them win. So making sure that if those areas are out of bounds, that they know about them. I would really love to see a buddy system or a mentor in place for our children when they first begin the school year. So someone who can remind them about where the safe toilets are, someone who can tell them that that is an out of bounds area, someone who can help them get to the library if they've forgotten the way to get there, someone who can remind them to pick up a pencil and a rubber and a pen before they walk to the library. Those are some of the top tips that I would get the children to know about and get organised for the children. But I also have 5 top tips for parents that I really would like to talk about. Now, the first thing is making that picture book, that I'm going to school workbook, so that we are showing the kids what is changing and what is staying the same. The other thing I would highly recommend to parents is that they do a profile of their child. Just a 1A4 sheet, and you'll find a pro forma of this in the essential guide if anyone wants to have a look at it. But it just talks about little things like what are the strengths of your child, what are the challenges of your child, what are some of the triggers that would have that start a meltdown, what's the best way to approach your child when he's having a meltdown, and any sensory issues that your child has with noise or smell or touch. And they are just some basic things that the teacher needs to know before the child actually comes into the classroom. The other thing I want to talk about is the uniform, making sure that the uniform has been washed and washed and washed. And here, this just comes from my own sensory son, who could never put on a uniform that was new because it was too scratchy on his skin. We had to wash it quite a number of times and actually throw it into the dryer to get it all nice and soft and squishy and faded before he could actually put it onto his skin. And make sure that the child gets used to wearing it at home before he actually gets there. So they're just some of the important tips that I would give to parents before they're actually going to start school.
Absolutely. And Anna, one of the things I recommend to parents is your How to Stop Your Words from Bumping into Someone Else's, with just all those little social skills they need for school, how to ask for help, how to put your hand up, what to do if kids say they don't want to play with them. Asking someone to play. I'm just flicking through it now. For me, you know, waiting in line, waiting with your hand up, waiting on the mat. I say to parents, you know, over the holidays, these are your bedtime stories. This is the important stuff to get this kid ready for school, particularly from preschool to school. If you can read these and talk about them, and really just do this, because these kids want that information. They want to know how to do this stuff. And I think by having your fantastic How to Stop Your Words from Bumping and the visuals there, you know, what to do if I lose, that just helps the child know, but it also prepares them that these things are going to happen, that you are going to be in the playground and kids say, I don't want to play with you. You are going to play a game and you're going to lose, because the reality is some of these kids at home and at preschool, especially if they're in a smaller preschool or daycare, they often, people were very accepting of them, but the primary school and secondary school playground is not as fluid and flexible,
yes.
And this can cause our kids so much anxiety. And also with that profile. Oh, sorry, Anna, I'm talking over you. Sorry, go.
That's fine.
With the student profile that you mentioned that's in our essential guide to secondary school, I just think that one page, the reason we made it a one-pager, if teachers have 30 kids in their class, they haven't got time to read some of the bigger profiles, so they just need that one pager to get them started. But I particularly think in secondary school, where the kid might have up to 8 teachers a day, it's very important to put a photo of your student on that profile, because some of the teachers the first week will have over 200 kids through their class, and this kid just isn't obvious. They often miss the cues, and that's why that one page summary with a nice photo of the kid. And I actually would, if you can, and with phones these days, with having a camera, I've started saying to people, I think you need a photo of them relaxed, not their school photo, because often that was a stressful day, and
yes,
a photo of them stressed, so people can see the neck change, like the change in the shoulders, the change in their face, those little characteristic changes that often in a secondary school, people miss that because they don't see the kid enough to learn the signals of a meltdown coming. So for me, that one pager and emailing it out to teachers, really worthwhile. Anything
yes,
else for secondary,
so
Anna?
No. There was just something else I wanted to mention there as well. you know your tip sheets that you've got, and you've got heaps and heaps of them. What I'm finding, well, what I'm talking to parents about is when you get those tip sheets, go through them and mark down which of the things on those tip sheets actually pertain to your particular child. What are the important things off those tip sheets that teachers need to know? And cross out the ones that aren't anything for your child. And then when you go to talk to the teacher later on and you're trying to give her some ideas of how to cope with the child, bring out your tip sheet and say, look, this is one of the things that my child does. This is one of the strategies to use. And that way the tip sheets are only, you know, maybe 10 or 12 things on each page, and it's not overwhelming for teachers either. So I find that the tip sheets are really, really helpful in when we make them very specific to our own child.
Absolutely. And that, I mean, I think in your book, Working with Teachers, you talk about not inundating teachers, but also really giving them specific helpful hints rather than them trying to work that out. So if you go through the tip sheet and do all the thinking, that makes it so much easier for the teacher because they, especially early in the year, they don't know which ones are relevant. So actually doing the shortcuts mm-hmm. for them, that is a brilliant idea, Anna.
That's right.
I tell people to do that. That's brilliant. Now, Anna, talking about the tip sheets, I thought our, I guess our most popular tip sheets is our 10 Essential Tips for Understanding ASD that we first wrote in our Essential Guide. But I know that's the tip sheet that I include in all my handouts and people find really helpful to understand the kids. But I just would love you to share, particularly in regard to Daniel, how these tips sort of making it more real to an example. So I might mm-hmm. just read through the actual tip, and if you could give us a little example for them, that would be fantastic. So number one is ASD students don't have to look at you all the time. Can you tell us about Daniel in that regard?
Certainly can. Daniel and a lot of the other adolescent boys that I work with all say the same kinds of things, that if I'm looking at you, I can't hear you. It's almost like if I've got to concentrate on one thing, then the other thing, the other senses are not going to work. So what they do tend to do is turn sideways so that they look at you with their peripheral vision, or they might look away or look down, or they might even completely turn their backs so that they can really concentrate on what you're saying.
Fantastic. And what about giving them time to answer your questions, which in schools can be a real trick? I know at home you've got more time to listen to Daniel. I know that was one of the things we discussed when we were writing the book. I was like, well, at school I can't wait because another kid will jump in there. So what worked with Daniel around waiting, learning, sort of giving him time, what worked for him?
Well, we actually taught him a couple of little phrases, and one of them was just a minute, and he would hold his hand up and look down at the same time. And the other one was just a sec, I'm thinking. So they were the kinds of things that we needed to teach him how to do as soon as someone started talking to him, if he realized that he couldn't process the information fast enough. And that took a little bit of time. It wasn't something that happened overnight. It took a lot of practice. We videotaped him doing it. We videotaped him doing it with someone who was trying to ask him questions, and so he could actually see what his reaction looked like. And we also gave him the, you know, the thinker pose? You know the statue called the thinker where he's leaning
over? Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
with the hand on the chin?
His hand on his chin, yeah. We did a kind of that kind of pose for him standing up, and at first it looked actually quite funny because he'd do this huge gesture that looked quite over the top, but at least he got the idea, and it made people stop what they were talking about, look at him, focus on him, and then he'd be ready to listen by then, ready to take on the information. So it actually caught people's attention and made them stop talking so much that he could then start processing the information.
Fantastic. And number three, if they feel under pressure, they'll give stock standard answers. Have you got any good examples for that one?
Yes. And here, Daniel, I quote Daniel quite a number of times. He would actually say to teachers whatever it was that they wanted to hear just so that he could get them out of his face. if he was really having difficulty with processing all of that information, he would just give him a stock standard answer like, yep, no worries, sir, and then walk away. And everyone would just assume that he would go and do whatever it was that they'd ask him to do. But, of course, he had no idea because he was just pulling the stuff out just to stop people talking at him. So you may find that a lot of our kids are using the stock standard answers but not really grasping what you are saying.
Yeah, and I think that's where you've got to watch. If they haven't followed through on the action, it's a stock standard response. It's just a, mm-hmm. yep, certainly, you know, whatever. Now, number yeah. four is that generalization, which for me I think is the hardest part, where they don't transfer information between places and people. So can you give us some examples where that happened to Daniel over the years?
Well, I think the best one is the one that we actually put in the book, where homework for teachers was a big issue, in that the first teacher had a yellow basket that he had to put his homework into, but when he went into the other teacher's office, she actually had a green basket. And it was in a different position. It wasn't even on her desk. It was on the side of the classroom. So it was very, very hard for him to actually hand in homework once he'd learnt that the yellow basket was for the homework. He couldn't quite figure out that the green one was also the homework basket for this other teacher, until we actually set it up as a rule where teacher X has a yellow basket for homework, teacher Y has a green basket for homework, and hers is placed over on the side of the classroom.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about this in the Essential Guide to Secondary, but this week I was talking to a mum whose son in Sydney's moved to Year 7, which is their first year in secondary, where he was doing the homework, but in primary school the teachers asked for the homework, and in secondary they were just expected to hand it in. And so he was doing all the homework and not handing it in because no one asked for it. And she yes. discovered all his homework was in his bag and hadn't been handed in for weeks, because she got a call from the school saying he hadn't been handing in work. And, you know you and I see this all the time, but I think any parents who are doing transitioning next year, you need to ask the teachers up front, how do the students hand in their homework? Do they put it on their desk, your desk at the beginning of the session, the end of the session? Do they put it in a basket? Because in primary school, we tend to nurture those things, but in secondary, every teacher has a different way of doing that. And some teachers are more lenient and give an extension, and some, if you don't hand it in on time, and other kids can work out those different rules for different teachers, but for these uh-huh. kids, they miss that information. So,
given to the classroom, they don't always listen to it.
No.
They don't always hear that information.
Yeah. So number five is they find organisation of their school equipment very difficult. Can you share with us some of the organisation stuff?
Oh, absolutely. I think Daniel was probably the most unorganised person I have ever met in my entire life. There was things everywhere, absolutely everywhere, until we came upon this beautiful thing called a Tudor organiser. And now you can find them in lots of different places, but at the time, this was the only one you could find. It actually had space for five different subjects inside it. You could actually put your ruler inside it, your pen, your pencil, and your eraser. There wasn't a lot of space. It actually had a pencil case that was sewn into the folder, so all of these things could actually remain inside it. You didn't have to go looking for it. The other thing that we did was we minimised the amount of pens and pencils that he had. He didn't particularly like colouring in that much, so we only gave him a few different colours that he carried around in that particular pencil case. But we made sure that he had the essentials with him all the time, and that was one of the best things that I ever found that worked for him and for lots of other students that I've worked with as well.
I agree, Anna, and I would recommend to people, and I know in the Essential Guide we've said this, but I would highly recommend that people don't get the one with the Velcro rip-off pencil case. They get the one with the sewn-in pencil case, because they'll either play with the Velcro and drive you mad, yeah, or lose the pencil case. But it's worth getting the Tudor one, because I find that one is stronger than some of the ones you see at the post office and things, but also the zip on that Tudor one seems to stay yes. nice and sturdy, and the pencil case actually being attached is really means that at least the stuff gets home, and then their personal assistant, i.e. mum or dad, can sort it out. And but when mm-hmm. stuff gets lost around the school in secondary, very hard to re-find stuff that's gone missing. Now, I hate to say it, Anna, but our time is ticking down. So I might leave the rest of those points we were going to sort of look at, those 10 tips, and just stop it at the 5 tips. But I suspect we're going to have to do another live chat, because I'm just looking on Facebook and people are asking us for tips for homework and all sorts of other things. But we can answer those on Facebook now and give people some live chat. But and I'd just really like to thank you for sharing. I always find you an incredibly inspirational mother, and in your proactiveness with Daniel, and you're a real credit, considering when he got diagnosed 20 years ago, there wasn't as much support or information around. So I'd like to thank you, Anna, but I'd also like to thank everyone for listening tonight, and I hope you found the live chat helpful. Many of you know my books and Anna's books, and just a reminder, there's hundreds more ideas in there to try. And Anna and I often get asked, since the blue book came out this year, whether they should get people should get the red or the blue book, which is more helpful. They're actually companion guides, so nothing's the same in each book. But if you're not sure, what I've done on the live chat handout tonight included the index, so you can see what's in the red book and what's in the blue book. So, for example, if you wanted to know about transition, that's in our first red book, page 52, whereas our 12 top tips for staying on task is in the blue book, page 34. The blue book has lots of strategies for writing social skills, lots of work on preventative breaks, and lots of completely different strategies to the red book. And we're sort of thinking we probably need to write a green book too, because there's so many other things we haven't put in those books. All of Anna's books are available on my website, and so if you want to get online and have a look at those, please do. And just a reminder, if you spend more than $200 Australian, you do get the Temple Grandin DVD for free until December 21st, 2012, and in New Zealand that's $250, and the Temple Grandin DVD is a must-watch, really, for everyone. Another inspiring mother in that video. This live chat is the last one for 2011. I'm sure many of you are looking at the calendar thinking, how did November get here? So I just want to thank all of you for listening in this year to the live chats and wish you all the best. I'm very excited. Next year we're kicking off in February with Tony Atwood has agreed to do a live chat for me. We've just got to secure the date in February. But that should be a fabulous way to start the year, because so many people who come to Tony's workshop say, we need this at the start of the year for teachers and parents. And Tony's also agreed this year to do next year, start the year off with the workshops early in the year. So if you want to come to the Tony workshop, the actual live workshop, can I encourage you to register? You don't have to pay now, but just register if you're interested. The reason I say that is last year all his workshops sold out, and so many people were disappointed that we had to turn them away. But it's with all the venues, they have a set number. If Anna and I both look forward to chatting you on Facebook now for the next hour or so. So you can post your questions on there for us. Can I just remind you to do that in the public area so that everyone can view your questions? If you're not comfortable posting on the public area, feel free to email me, but not through Facebook. Having as many friends as I do, there's a lot of emails and questions that come through there that it's very hard for me to filter. So if you would be kind enough to go to my website, www.sulakey.com, you'll see there it says email Sue. And I really look forward to hearing from you through there, and I'll obviously get back to you in the next week for those questions. But for the next little while, Anna and I will be available on Facebook, on my Facebook, to answer your questions. So thank you, everyone, for listening in. It's been amazing having Anna sharing her journey, and I hope for many of you it's been as inspirational as for you it has been for me. So thanks, Anna.
thank you very much, Sue. I've really enjoyed our chat this evening and looking forward to chatting to everyone else online tonight.
Fantastic. Thanks, Anna. Bye.
Thanks, Sue. Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.
We had such expectations, we would soon be given birth to the next Chopin, the next Einstein, the greatest child on earth. And we'd be the perfect family, soon we'd have the perfect kid. We'd never have a challenge or a problem, God forbid. Oh, but life had different plans. So I need for you to understand. Don't desert me. Don't ignore. I need friends now more than I ever did before. But please don't pity me. I'm a parent just like you, it's true. But I have special needs. I need you to notice that my life's different from yours. I need you not to judge me. Don't compare.